Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The U.S. and the EU declare sanctions on Russian officials, and President Obama and Mahmoud Abbas meet at the White House. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. U.S. President Barack Obama has pledged unwavering U.S. support for Ukraine. It comes after Crimea's declaration of independence and moves toward joining the Russian Federation. Mr. Obama spoke today at the White House, describing a set of sanctions on Ukrainian and Russian officials announced only hours earlier by his administration. He said Washington stands ready to impose further sanctions if necessary and if Russia chooses to escalate the situation.
I believe there's still a path to resolve this situation diplomatically, in a way that addresses the interests of both Russia and Ukraine. That includes Russia pulling its forces in Crimea back to their bases, supporting the deployment of additional international monitors in Ukraine, and engaging in dialogue with the Ukrainian government, which has indicated its openness to pursuing constitutional reform as they move forward towards elections this spring. But throughout this process, we're going to stand firm in our unwavering support for Ukraine.
Mr. Obama said Vice President Joe Biden leaves for Europe later today to discuss the situation with NATO leaders. The president himself is slated to go to Europe next week. The announcement followed a similar move by the European Union, which earlier today designated 21 officials from Russia and Ukraine for travel bans and trade sanctions. VOA's Al Pessin has that part of the story from London.
Officials say the top leaders of the 28 EU nations could adopt more sanctions at a summit later this week, particularly if Russia moves to annex Crimea. For now, though, the European sanctions are lighter than the steps the United States announced at about the same time Monday. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton defended the decision.
I don't believe this has anything to do with softer or harder approaches. We've taken our decision based on the best information and work that we've done to establish what we believe is the right approach for the European Union.
Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
Malaysia says the search for a missing passenger jet is underway along both the northern and southern corridor, where it's believed to have been deliberately diverted. This is Defense Minister Hishamuddin Hussein.
Countries including Malaysia, Australia, China, Indonesia, Kazakhstan have already initiated search and rescue operations. The Royal Malaysian Air Force and the Royal Malaysian Navy have deployed assets to the southern corridor.
About two-thirds of the 239 people aboard the missing Boeing 777 were Chinese nationals. And with the expansion of the search effort, Beijing's foreign ministry leveled a new attack on Malaysia's openness in handling the investigation. Investigators believe the aircraft flew either north toward Central Asia or south, deeper into the vast Indian Ocean in the hours after it mysteriously vanished on March 8th. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott today agreed to take charge of the southern section of the search at the request of the Malaysian Prime Minister.
We will do our duty to ensure that our search and rescue responsibilities are maintained and upheld, and we will do our duty to the families of the 230 people on that aircraft who are still absolutely devastated by their absence.
Malaysian investigators are also looking into the pilots and engineers who may have had contact with the plane before it left Kuala Lumpur. U.S. President Barack Obama is to host his Palestinian counterpart Mahmoud Abbas at the White House today. They are to discuss the stalled Middle East peace process. The meeting comes ahead of the April 29th target date for a framework agreement from the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. The Pentagon says U.S. Navy SEALs have seized an oil tanker carrying crude that was illicitly obtained from a rebel-held port in Libya. The Defense Department said today that no one was hurt in boarding of the stateless vessel that was seized earlier this month by three armed Libyans. The statement went on to say that the action was requested by the Libyan and the Cypriot governments and approved by President Obama. A Swedish research institute says India is the world's largest arms importer. It more than doubled its weapons purchases over the past 5 years. More at VOAnews.com. I'm Frances Alonso, VOA News.
Good evening, and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Joe DiCapua in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight...
Eritrean refugees have been fleeing their country in huge numbers again since 2004, about 2,000 to 3,000 a month. Large numbers, around 2,000 a month, are going into eastern Sudan, where since 2011, criminals, traffickers, have been kidnapping them and taking them into Egypt against their will.
That's Jerry Simpson, senior researcher for Human Rights Watch. The group has called for tough action against human traffickers. Also coming up, U.S. Navy SEALs seize a tanker carrying Libyan oil. A car bomb in Benghazi kills five. And the U.S. ambassador to South Sudan comments on the troubling conditions there. Well, of those stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young, music, and gold mining in Uganda. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the Pentagon says U.S. Navy SEALs have seized an oil tanker carrying crude illicitly obtained from a rebel-held port in Libya. The Defense Department says no one was hurt in the boarding of the, quote, stateless vessel seized earlier this month by three armed Libyans. The action was requested by the Libyan and Cypriot governments and approved by U.S. President Obama. The raid was conducted Sunday night local time in international waters southeast of Cyprus. U.S. sailors are now in control of the ship called Morning Glory. They will soon return the tanker and its cargo back to a port in Libya. The Morning Glory loaded the oil earlier this month in the Libyan port of Al Sadra, which is controlled by a rebel militia group. The tanker had been a North Korean flagship, but Pyongyang has denied any responsibility, saying the vessel is actually linked to an Egyptian company. North Korea then revoked the registration of the ship. Also in Libya, at least five soldiers are dead and more than 10 people injured after a car bomb exploded in the eastern city of Benghazi. Reports say the bomb targeted a military base during an inauguration ceremony for new officers. Benghazi was the birthplace of the 2011 uprising that eventually toppled longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi. Since then, a weak central government has not been able to enforce security in the city, which is a stronghold of militias. The military and police have become frequent targets in that city. The group Human Rights Watch is praising a UN Human Rights Council statement that calls on Egypt and Sudan to investigate and prosecute human traffickers. The council acted last Friday and also called on Egypt and Sudan to identify and prosecute any security officials involved in the trafficking of kidnapped Eritrean refugees. Jerry Simpson is the senior refugee researcher for Human Rights Watch. From Geneva, he spoke to me about the group's concerns.
Eritrean refugees have been fleeing their country in huge numbers again since 2004, about 2,000 to 3,000 a month. Large numbers, around 2,000 a month, are going into eastern Sudan, where since 2011, criminals, traffickers, have been kidnapping them and taking them into Egypt against their will, where they've been torturing them for tens of thousands of dollars in ransom. And they pour molten plastic on them, rape them, beat them, suspend them from ceilings, and then hold mobile phones to their heads so that their relatives can hear their screams and pay the ransom. We've recently documented security force collusion with the traffickers, both in eastern Sudan and in Egypt. And the Human Rights Council statement from last week calls on Egypt and Sudan to investigate these terrible crimes, to prosecute the traffickers, and to investigate police and military who are working with them.
Now, how much weight does the statement from the UN Human Rights Council actually have?
It's the first time that an international forum has addressed this issue. Until now, there have been a couple of press releases from the UN Refugee Agency, which, you know, studiously get ignored. There have been a lot of media coverage, both internationally and in Sudan and Egypt. But this is the first time an international UN institution has squarely addressed this issue. That came, in fact, last week, one day after the European Parliament also adopted a resolution condemning what was going on, including law enforcement collusion with the traffickers. And so Egypt has responded confidentially, apparently, to this statement, admitting for the first time in writing that these crimes are taking place in Sinai, but denying that any security force collusion is involved. And it remains to be seen now how Egypt and Sudan will respond on the ground. But this statement has forced them to publicly acknowledge these crimes are taking place.
What about Sudan? Any public acknowledgement of any activity in their area?
In January of 2012, United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, visited eastern Sudan to look into some of these problems, this mass kidnapping of Eritrean refugees as they cross from Eritrea into eastern Sudan. And since then, Sudan has acknowledged that these trafficking crimes are taking place. However, it's taken very few steps to prosecute traffickers, just a handful of cases, and has only prosecuted four law enforcement officials involved in these crimes. Given that we're talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of people that have gone through these terrible situations, these numbers are laughable. And so we're hoping that this statement in the Human Rights Council will also put pressure on Sudan to increase its response to these terrible crimes.
Is there any action you would like to see the international community take aside from what happened at the UN Human Rights Council?
Well, what is key from our perspective is that UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, does all it can to properly monitor the ongoing kidnapping of Eritrean refugees in and around the refugee camps in eastern Sudan, where UNHCR is active, and to report on how many people are being kidnapped and cases in which they hear of Sudanese police in particular who are working hand in hand with these traffickers, in some cases handing refugees over to traffickers for torture in Sudanese police stations. We think the UN has a very important role there to monitor and report on what's happening.
How many of these refugees who've been kidnapped actually are returned home?
The situation for Eritreans in Sinai, when they've been tortured, generally leads to them ending up in police stations. So they either they pay the ransom and are released, or they manage to escape the traffickers, and then they're intercepted by Egyptian security forces. And instead of being assisted and protected as trafficking victims, in some cases, people who have been horrendously tortured, including gang rape of women, amputation of fingers, terrible burning of limbs. Instead of assisting and protecting these people, they're prosecuted for unlawful presence in Egypt, detained in inhuman and degrading conditions, and then they're deported to Ethiopia, which has an agreement with Egypt to take deported Eritreans. So part of our report that we released last month in February calls on Egypt to properly protect and assist these victims, not to basically persecute them further.
Jerry Simpson is the senior refugee researcher for Human Rights Watch. He spoke to me from Geneva. The U.S. ambassador to South Sudan says there is no military solution to the political crisis in that country. Susan Page says mediators of the Intergovernmental Authority for Development, or IGAD, should include the views of civil society and the seven released SPLM leaders in the search for a peaceful end to the conflict. She told reporter John Tanza the U.S. government is working hard to end the fighting in South Sudan.
My government is supporting the monitoring and verification mechanism. We've supported it with financial resources, with funding for staff, as well as for helicopters to be able to fly and observe whether one side or the other side or neither side is observing the cessation of hostilities. This is going to be an ongoing battle because right now both sides are still posturing for control on the ground and fighting continues. Until that mechanism is up and running, I think we're going to be struggling with seeing the parties continuing to fight. And we just simply reiterate that there cannot be a solution militarily to this conflict, to something that is first and foremost political and where the demands of the people do need to be heard. Right now, the talks are on a pause, and a civil society conference is going to be organized in Addis Ababa next week. And we're looking forward to that and having the mediators and the parties be able to hear from civil society some of the grievances that have led to this conflict.
There's been a talk of formation of an interim government that will exclude Dr. Riek Machar and President Kiir. Is that a viable option?
I think that right now it's important that the fighting stop on the ground. And as the peace talks get underway, we are working with IGAD to offer any suggestions, but it is the mediators who ultimately will be putting forward a variety of different proposals after having listened to all of the parties, not just the warring parties that have taken up arms, but also to civil society as well as to others, including the seven detained who were released to the custody of Kenya. They also have some words to say, and I think it's important that the mediators hear from everyone in South Sudan that can be represented.
And the government in Juba has been on record saying that they are doing their best to correct some of the issues that Western diplomats have been raising, issues such as human rights abuse, security sector reform, and then media freedom. You are coming from Juba. Have you seen any concrete signs of improvement?
No, I think right now, especially while they are in a crisis and the government is, the rebels are fighting the government, I think it's very difficult to institute any of these reforms on any sort of a longer lasting basis. Before the conflict broke out, they were in the process of trying to adopt a civil society, non-humanitarian organization bill in the parliament that severely restricted fundamental freedoms and human rights. So this has been a trend. I don't think that it's new during this particular time, but I do believe that it will be difficult for them to make the changes that are necessary, especially at a time when so many in the army have deserted or have defected to the rebel side. That, to me, indicates that there is a much bigger problem, and it is not something that only the outside powers supposedly want. The people of South Sudan are speaking and saying that this is not how they would like for things to go, or they would not be defecting in such large numbers.
That's Susan Page, U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan. She spoke to reporter John Tanza at the State Department. Analysts are calling for a stronger international response to end civil wars in Sudan and South Sudan. Critics accuse the Khartoum government of using violence to suppress grievances in Darfur and southern Kordofan and Blue Nile states. And in South Sudan, government troops are fighting rebel factions of the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement. U.S. policy toward the two countries was the topic of discussion at a recent hearing of the House Subcommittee on Africa. William Eagle reports on the opinions of some of those who testified at the hearing.
John Prendergast of the Washington-based Enough Project says the crises in the two countries call for a more robust U.S. approach to peace, democracy, and accountability. Prendergast says the U.S. should expand from one to two envoys in the region, part of a strategy some analysts call a diplomatic surge. Currently, the U.S. Department of State has one envoy to serve both Sudan and South Sudan, Ambassador Donald Booth.
One special envoy, no matter how capable Ambassador Booth is, pales in comparison, I think, to the current diplomatic requirements. The wars in both countries are so complicated, they require their own envoys. And the interplay between these two conflicts and the broader region demands a deeper political team upon which these two envoys could rely.
Prendergast says the team would include currently serving senior foreign service officers, retired ambassadors, and other regional experts. He also says U.S. policymakers should develop a unified approach to conflicts in the Sudanese regions of Darfur, the Nuba Mountains, the contested territory of Abyei, and the eastern states of Blue Nile and North Kordofan. So far, he says, Khartoum has used a successful divide-and-conquer strategy in subduing these areas and in dividing diplomatic efforts to bring peace. Others want an even more personalized approach to U.S. policy in the region, one they compare to diplomatic shock treatment. Waleed Fares is the co-secretary general of the Transatlantic Legislative Group on Counterterrorism.
I would strongly recommend that the President of the United States, President Obama, will address in public the issue of Sudan. People in southern Sudan, those commanders on the ground, needs to have a very high, important personality that would address them from Washington, that would ask them to cease fire. This is a civil war. And in civil wars, they're not going to listen to diplomats. They're going to listen to the highest personality.
Farris suggests the administration bring into the effort former President George W. Bush, who met personally with South Sudanese leader and current president Salva Kiir during his administration. Farris also offered suggestions for dealing with the Republic of Sudan and President Omar al-Bashir, whose administration is at war with several ethnic groups.
We need to invite to Washington representatives of the Beja, of the Nubians, of the Darfuris, and of the Kordofan and other areas in northern Sudan, so that the American public would understand what are their claims and what are their difficulties. The president would call on Mr. Bashir and tell him, you are under international indictment and you are responsible for the security and the rights of these four African communities in Sudan.
Special Envoy Ambassador Donald Booth says the Obama administration has reached out to former high-ranking officials and will continue to do so.
The administration indeed had reached out to previous administrations, the previous presidents and members of their senior leadership, and had tried to engage them, and some of them did indeed intervene, make calls out to the government in South Sudan to try to put an end to the conflict, to try to call for an early cessation of hostilities and to sit down at the peace table. It was former Secretary Rice who tried to engage President Kiir. Former President Carter did as well. We've had many calls to Salva Kiir, as well as to Riek Machar, by senior administration officials, and we're calibrating when we need to use which official to try to move an issue at the particular time. So that's something that's certainly on the table and will be used when we consider that that would be the best way forward at that time to move us off of a sticking point or otherwise break any logjam.
Prendergast says bringing peace to the region will mean closer international collaboration. He says the United States could lead a coalition that would, if necessary, consider targeted sanctions against both countries. Besides isolating high-ranking officials, the strategy could include stopping the sales by Khartoum of so-called conflict gold, as well as linking debt relief to ending conflict and initiating democratic reforms. A broad effort with the participation of the regional group IGAD, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, is working to end the conflict in South Sudan. The conflicts in both Sudans has left tens of thousands of refugees in the region and more than 1 million internally displaced people. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
Nigeria's interior minister has refused to resign after stampedes of job applicants left more than 16 people dead Saturday. It happened while people applied for jobs at the government's immigration service testing sites around the country. The number of casualties is expected to mount. One Lagos newspaper reports 23 deaths, but that number has not been independently confirmed. A spokesman for the opposition People's Democratic Party demanded an investigation and called for the resignation of Interior Minister Abe Moro. Moro said security was not handled well, but larger crowds than expected led to the tragedy. The National Immigration Service administered tests at more than 30 locations to fill 5,000 positions. But more than 500,000 people paid a $6 fee and were invited to take the 35-minute aptitude exam. Local leaders in Nigeria's Niger Delta want to unite competing communities to put pressure on Shell Petroleum. They want the oil giant to pay billions of dollars in reparations and clean up fishing areas, they say, were polluted in a 2011 oil spill. Shell disputes the claim. It says the spill never reached Nigerian shores or damaged the fishing industry. Heather Murdoch reports for VOA from the Niger Delta.
On the beach of Yuba Bay, a fishing community in the Niger Delta, protesters demand journalists get off the boat to hear what they have to say.
So we don't defish your day.
About 2 million lives were devastated by the Bonga oil spill, they say, holding up water that appears to be polluted with oil. They say their children are always hungry because there are no fish to eat or sell.
Destroy the river. So we don't keep fish again. We don't keep fish again. The river is polluted. There is no fish.
But Shell says the spill from its Bonga oil field was cleaned up swiftly after the leak, and it never harmed the communities. The company says there was another spill from an unknown vessel shortly after the Bonga spill, and Shell spent several million dollars cleaning up both spills, even though the second was not its fault. But as the protesters shake branches as a symbol of anger, they demand humanitarian aid, payment for lost incomes, and that Shell clean up the oil, saying oil companies have been taking advantage of Delta residents for decades. On the other side of the beach, Sia shows us an oil pipeline that runs from a nearby processing plant through the village and into the water.
This is where the pipe passes. Oil pipeline. This is high pressure pipeline. As you can see, the pipe, they are corroded. This pipe are corroded. If this pipe mistakenly gets split now, there will be oil spillage all over. This place, there is crude passing this place.
Other protesters lead us into their village. There's no electricity or hospital, and young men pull more dirty water out of what looks like a spring. They drink it while photographers take pictures. The men want people to see that they are drinking water polluted with oil. About an hour away by speedboat in the nearest city, Wari, traditional rulers say they want to negotiate with the oil company, known locally as SPDC, for the sum of $5.6 billion to compensate and to clean up fishing communities. This is His Royal Highness Ibamuga Ojukwusen.
We are here as a people, collectively with one voice. Let our cry be heard. Let Bonga's bill of SPDC in 20th December 2011 be adequately compensated, the communities cleaned, relief materials sent, and let us be paid. I would want to rest my case.
Other leaders say Niger Delta communities have in the past failed to extract compensation from oil companies because the communities are hopelessly divided on the issue of who is and who is not owed. At this conference in Wari, leaders and lawyers work to unite communities. But some attendees say they believe that if Shell does pay, the only real beneficiaries will be the leaders. Early this year, the Nigerian government said it was fining Shell $11.5 billion for the Bonga spill. Shell says it has never paid any fines because it is not liable, legally or otherwise. Protesters on the beach say the issue is simpler than that. They say they want the company to pay up or get out.
The next step we'll take, if the protests do not succeed, SPDC will leave our land. That's what we'll do. And no army man can stop us.
In the past, Delta residents have rebelled against oil companies and the government. Traditional leaders say they fear more unrest in the Niger Delta if the people's concerns are not addressed. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Ubebe, Nigeria.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Joe DiCapua in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. U.S. Navy SEALs seize a tanker carrying Libyan oil, and Human Rights Watch praises a U.N. Human Rights Council statement criticizing human trafficking. Coming up, small-scale gold mining in Uganda and the ongoing loss of the world's tree cover. I'm Joe DiCapua in Washington. We're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports, and we could use a little sunshine on this snowy, stormy Washington day. And here's Sunny. He's going to serve us up some men's tennis.
Serving up some tennis, Joe. Serbian tennis star Novak Djokovic has lifted the trophy at the Indian Wells tournament in Southern California. Djokovic rallied to beat Swiss rival Roger Federer, as we hear now from reporter Craig Gabriel.
Novak Djokovic won his third championship at the Indian Wells Tennis Garden as he came back from a set down to beat Roger Federer in a highly engaging final that lasted 2 hours 12 minutes, 3-6, 6-3, 7-6. Djokovic took a deep breath of relief as Federer tamely sent a backhand into the bottom of the net on match point. Djokovic hadn't played well this event, but he had hung on with his matches. He turned the tables on Federer, who beat him a couple of weeks ago in Dubai. Djokovic will stay at number 2 in the rankings, but Federer will move up to 5. This is Djokovic's 18th Masters 1000 title and his 42nd career title, but the first for the year. Craig Gabriel for VOA Sports, Indian Wells.
Thanks, Craig. Now let's go to Morocco, the host country of the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations football tournament. Morocco's coastal city of Agadir, located on the shores of the Atlantic Ocean near the foot of the Atlas Mountains, was the venue for some top-notch professional golf over the weekend. The Spaniard Alejandro Canizares wrapped up an impressive wire-to-wire victory at the Trophy Hassan II tournament. Canizares finished at 19 under par and 5 strokes ahead of English golfer Andy Sullivan. It was the second European Tour golf title for Canizares, but his first in almost 8 years. The Spaniard told reporter Nick Dye he's delighted to win the Moroccan event.
It's great. It was a wonderful week. It started off better than I could imagine, and it's unbelievable. Golf is just such a special game, because I came here a little depressed about my game. It wasn't on. I wasn't hitting the ball well. I wasn't putting well. And after 10 minutes practicing with my coach and 30 minutes practicing with a putting coach, it just clicked, and it just felt so natural, so easy. And it felt like the golf course was easy for me. Yesterday I was very nervous, and I kept the pace, and today I was also very nervous in that last hole with that divot right in front of it. It's just a great week. Great to follow up. I think my father played here and never won. He played here a few years, so it's just a special moment for me. And it's been a while. It's been a long time, and I have to thank my caddy. Really handled me well today, and it was an unbelievable moment. The first win was 8 years ago, and that second win came difficult. I had a few chances along the way, but this was just magnificent for me.
Well, you have been second on a few occasions in the meantime, but did you ever worry whether the second win was going to come?
No, I wasn't worried. I thought if I kept working on it and kept my game on, it could come anyways. It's a good thing I had a 7-shot cushion on the last, because that couple of lies I got with 2 divots, it was very difficult. But just, it's a great first step for the rest of my career, I think, and I have to just keep going and keep working on it and get in better shape and be more professional, and hopefully I get to where I think I can get.
Well, don't beat yourself up about the last hole. Just accept that you've done this in style, haven't you? You couldn't have won it in any better fashion.
No, I just couldn't ask for better. In my head, I was pointing at 20, and I got it to 21, and it's a pity. But who cares? I won the tournament, and it's just amazing for me. I mean, I don't have much words. You try to put it, you picture this moment, and you try to think about what to say, but it's just, you know, the words don't come out the right way, and it's just a very, very happy moment.
Beautiful prize you get, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. I thought I couldn't get it home with me, but I'm going to take it home, so it's going to be a good... I want to leave it in a good place.
That's Spanish golfer Alejandro Canizares, who's taking home that beautiful Trophy Hassan prize. And Alejandro was talking with reporter Nick Dye in Agadir, Morocco. In African youth football, Nigeria is off to a winning start at the FIFA Under-17 Women's World Cup in Costa Rica. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Ouma has that story, plus a package of African athletic news.
Nigeria pipped China 2-1 at the start of their Group D campaign at the FIFA Women's Under-17 World Cup in Alajuela, Costa Rica on Sunday. Early on Saturday, bronze medalists Ghana beat North Korea 2-0 in Group B action in Liberia, while tournament debutants Zambia lost 2-0 to Italy in their Group A tie in the capital, San Jose. Turning to athletics, world junior cross-country champion Faith Chepngetich Kipyegon led a 1-2-3-4 Kenyan sweep of the senior women's 8-kilometer race at the 4th Africa Cross-Country Championships in Kampala, Uganda on Sunday. World junior cross-country championship silver medalist Leonard Barsoton comfortably won the senior men's 12-kilometer race, in which Kenya claimed the top 5 places. Earlier on, Kenyans Moses Mukono and Agnes Tirop prevailed in the junior men's 8 kilometers and junior women's 6 kilometers respectively. The only non-Kenyan individual medalists were Eritrean bronze medalist Afewoki Behane in the junior men's race and Ethiopian silver medalist Alemiru Heroye in the junior women's contest. Kenya retained all 4 team titles. In the senior men's category, Uganda was second and Ethiopia third, while in the senior women's race, Ethiopia came second ahead of Uganda. Eritrea pipped Ethiopia for the silver medal in the junior men's contest, as Ethiopia placed second and Uganda third in the junior women's event. In Portugal, Kenyan Olympic and World Championship 10,000-meter finalist Bedan Karoki triumphed in his debut at the half marathon in the Portuguese capital Lisbon on Sunday. Covering the distance in 59 minutes and 58 seconds, Karoki is the only athlete to complete the course in under 1 hour. He was followed across the finish line by fellow Kenyans Silas Kibruto, Ezekiel Chebi, then Eritrean Tekle Mariam Mehdin. Meanwhile, Ethiopian Werknesh Degefa clocked 1 hour 8 minutes and 46 seconds to win the women's race. Kenyan Jemima Jelagat was 2 seconds adrift, while another Kenyan, Flamena Chepchirchir, was third. Mark Oman, Johannesburg, South Africa.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. Let's give a Sunny Side of Sports birthday shout out for Friday Osameke, who's celebrating a birthday this evening in Abba, Nigeria. Friday has been a loyal VOA listener over the years, and he's peppered my mailbag with more than a few emails and letters, too. Happy birthday to Friday on this Monday. Elsewhere in African athletics, Kenyans swept the men's and women's titles at the New York City Half Marathon on Sunday. Jeffrey Mutai was the overall winner in 60 minutes and 50 seconds, and Sally Kipyego captured the women's crown in 68 minutes and 30 seconds. New York City also stages a full marathon each year on the first Sunday in November. Jeffrey Mutai has twice won the New York City Marathon, last year as well as in 2011. Our VOA listeners will remember also in 2011, Jeffrey Mutai ran the fastest marathon time ever, 2 hours, 3 minutes, and 2 seconds in winning the Boston Marathon. However, Jeffrey's time wasn't recognized as an official world record since the Boston course does not meet the international criteria to be eligible for the mark. Getting back to the New York City half marathon course, it took the runners through Central Park and Times Square before finishing on Wall Street. Somalia-born Mo Farah, Britain's double Olympic champion, fell during the race just before the 10-kilometer mark. But Mo got up and he wound up finishing second overall behind Jeffrey Mutai in 61 minutes and 7 seconds. Next month in London, Mo Farah is scheduled to run the full marathon distance for the first time. He won gold medals for Britain at both 5,000 meters and 10,000 meters at the 2012 London Olympics. The 68-team U.S. Men's Collegiate Basketball Championship Tournament tips off this week at arenas across the United States. The single elimination competition is one of the most popular sporting events here in the USA, and it will culminate April 7th when the national championship game is played at AT&T Stadium near Dallas, Texas. Now, one of the African players I hope to watch during the tournament is center Joel Embiid of the University of Kansas Jayhawks. Embiid is from Yaoundé, Cameroon, and he celebrated his 20th birthday on Sunday. Embiid is also rated one of the top collegiate players in the country. However, he's missed the past few games for Kansas because of a back injury, and it's not clear when he'll return to the court. Kansas is scheduled to play its first game Friday against Eastern Kentucky in St. Louis, Missouri. Teams are given various seedings, and top seeds open the tournament against lower-seeded teams. However, there are always upsets in this tournament, which has the nickname March Madness because of those upsets. And in case you're wondering, Kansas is seeded second in its regional grouping, while Eastern Kentucky is seeded 15th. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Joe DiCapua.
March Madness. All these storms we've been having in March.
Lots of madness.
Thank you, Sonny. You can listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And don't forget, on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17 hours UTC, right here on the VOA. I'm Joe DiCapua in Washington. Coming up, we'll hear about small-scale gold mining in Uganda and the rapid ongoing loss of tree cover. But first, some music. Here's Abiba.
Mayada, Macheki. Mayada, Macheki. Mayada, Macheki. Mayada,
Abiba.
Mayada,
Abiba.
Mayada,
Abiba. Very good, Abiba. Very good, Abiba. Juju me, Abiba. Konisa, Abiba. Yerusa, Abiba. Konisa, Abiba. Nawaenu na Jimmy say, Abiba. Jimmy sa,
Yeah, report draw and through NTRP and DC law. Yen ya Clinton near the Yako High Court. President Sequoia at 2 seesaw. You and you what? Give me some more. The dead that's a tea pampa and it's draw. To start with the Ghana, yeah, win the raw. Defend this or say for any football. Me what did you see? Me pim support. Miss Naminaso. Take tall. No be no commentary. Yeah, be a flaw. Grab your grab and your draw. Auntie your rabba put on put off. Miss Abiba. Try hardcore. Ace, ace, ace.
Abiba, hey, Abiba. Abiba, hey.
Afina mama, mi babe so udo mi opa me dunja. Mi kende bi debi, danchi bi yuma. Uni makumbe mu imani me ni susuma pa. Sabo che adiza yo baba. Ni nante ni ni kasa kwa ma fanela. Ni ni kumi kwa ni 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 mama. Ma, ma, ah, ah, show. Adu wa mi wama ono ensanda. Mi baba me beso udo ni sa sindia. Yo, yo, show, show.
Apua nye mi suba ni a raw raw draws. June so kurobo, wa ye dangerous. Past time one, kre mi come across. Mi doni na so so se abele wo. May you walk with my boss? Obi stem ya can, na mi di ni cause. Me wo physical cross, me in tongue draws. Hey, me am a cast, and name is Thor. When they wo Caesar, pharmacies, na me your domo bleeder. Na me home put away, say class one teacher. Papa, touch my dear, say Roman sister. OCP word, OCita. Fall on my team, what's in the pizza? Bruta, the Bella, the network, Akaida. Hali, 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 Mr. Duro, better.
Abiba, hey, Abiba, Abiba, hey, Abiba, ay, very good Abiba,
Bayada.
Very good Abiba, juju mi Abiba,
Bayada.
Konsa Abiba,
Bacheki.
Yeno sa Abiba,
Bayada.
Konsa Abiba,
Bayada.
Well, having lost their traditional herds, the local people of Karamoja, Uganda, have increasingly turned to small-scale gold mining. It provides them with a meager but fairly steady source of income. However, with large mining interests moving into the region, even their gold could soon be taken from them. Hillary Hewler has more for VOA from Karamoja.
As a child, Livingston Akuru's world revolved around cows. His family's herd was large, over 100 animals. Akuru lives in Karamoja, northeastern Uganda, and his people, the Karamojong, have long been semi-nomadic pastoralists. Livestock is at the heart of their culture, and a man's worth is counted in cattle. But more importantly, explains Akuru, cows have kept his people alive for centuries in a harsh, dry land.
When you have animals, there you can shed blood of the animal and you eat. You can eat meat there. You can get milk there. So there's no any more anger there. They can survive if the animals are there.
But a combination of forced disarmament, drought, and disease has taken its toll, and the cows of Karamoja are disappearing. Akuru's family has only a handful of animals left, and he was forced to find other ways to survive. Like tens of thousands of Karamojong, he turned to gold. Now, Akuru spends his days hacking away at the bottom of a dry riverbed, mixing the earth with water and painstakingly sifting the mud for tiny gleaming nuggets to sell at the market. Sometimes he makes up to $3 a day. Other days, he says, he finds nothing at all.
Like now, for example, if you have not already any work, that means that you will sleep hungry. If you have not found it, no food. It is not easy also to get. the girl itself. You use a lot of strength, energy like that, and it is not every day that you can go and get it.
Simon Naniero, head of the Karamoja Miners Association, estimates that around 80,000 people in the region make a living panning for gold. Crops in Karamoja often fail, and there's little industry. Without the gold, he says, he doesn't know what else they would do to survive.
You know, the Karamojong region didn't know about any other thing apart from looking after their animals. So people looked for alternatives. So more and more numbers are going for mining because it's the easiest way to get money.
But change is coming fast. Recently, international mining companies have begun exploration in Karamoja, looking for limestone, marble, iron ore, and, of course, gold. A Human Rights Watch report released February called attention to the threat these companies could pose if communities aren't properly consulted. Because land in Karamoja is communally owned, it said, the potential for land grabbing is very real. Hillary Hewler for VOA News, Karamoja.
The world's tree cover is disappearing at an alarming rate. More than 2 million square kilometers were lost between 2000 and 2012. That's the equivalent of 50 football fields every minute. Now there's a powerful new computer tool that provides reliable, up-to-the-minute information to help both governments and conservationists stem those losses and also target criminal activity. VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports.
Fire, illegal logging, and land gobbled up by farms or mining and oil operations are chronic problems in tropical forests worldwide. By the time these activities are discovered, it's often too late to do anything about them, much less determine who's at fault. Enter Global Forest Watch, an online forest monitoring system created by the World Resources Institute and 40 partner groups. At its launch, WRI President Andrew Steer said the program will be a game changer.
It is possible to bring, for the first time ever, really real-time data at a very local level to everybody in the world, and that's what Global Forest Watch is all about.
Global Forest Watch embeds high-resolution satellite images with key information in a simple-to-use interactive website, says WRI's Nigel Sizer, who heads the initiative.
If you can use a Google map to find a friend's house, then you can use Global Forest Watch to understand what's happening to forests in your community, across your country, or even on the other side of the world, and then take action.
Deforestation in the tropics is increasing by about 2,000 square kilometers a year, according to WRI, with half that loss in Brazil and Indonesia. Sizer says Global Forest Watch can help slow that trend.
It allows the government to focus their enforcement efforts in areas where illegal forest clearing is taking place. It allows companies like Nestle and Unilever, who've said, we don't want deforestation in the products that we're selling. They're saying, we're going to use Global Forest Watch so that we know which of our suppliers are doing a good job and which ones are doing a bad job.
NASA has been collecting high-resolution satellite images of the Earth since 1973. And when it made the archive public in 2008, it gave scientists the ability to assess changes in the Earth's landscape. For Global Forest Watch, Google deployed the computing power of its Earth Engine technology to turn the latest 12 years of data into an interactive map, easily available to everyone, everywhere. What would have taken a single computer 15 years took Google just a couple of days. Google Earth Outreach and Earth Engine Manager Rebecca Moore says the aim is to bridge an information gap.
The science exists, the data exists, but the amount of data that's required, satellite imagery data, to actually have an accurate, detailed, current picture of the world's forests, it's quadrillions of pixels, right? It's like billions of megabytes of data. No one's ever been able to store, much less analyze that data before.
The satellite images are so detailed, it's possible to determine whether a section of forest has been logged, burned, or felled by disease. Moore says users can take pictures of what happens on the ground and add to the database.
This is, you know, here's the license plate on the truck with the illegal logs on the Trans-Amazon Highway that automatically can get uploaded into Global Forest Watch and support law enforcement. So it's a combination of the two, both of which are unprecedented, that are coming together, powered by the internet.
No one hungers for this information more than Ecuadorian Juan Carlos Hintage, who coordinates dialogue among native peoples and governments in 9 Amazon basin countries. He says the information from Global Forest Watch will advance that conversation.
It's a simple way to share our voice and histories. The first time using the Global Forest Watch, we can easily upload alerts, photos for the entire world to see when encroachment happens in our customary forest lands, and to monitor these lands in the near real time.
Hintage says while he's encouraged about its potential, Global Forest Watch will only be as good as its users, who he says must mobilize to protect the world's forests before it's too late. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune into Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And thank you for your comments. You can send your emails to africa@voanews.com, or you can call us right here in the U.S. at 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press 3030 to leave us a message. Be sure to leave your name and country in that message. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Joe DiCapua in Washington. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa Tonight news team, producer Bill Workinger, Big Bill we call him, and our engineer, the wily Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Fresh fighting has broken out in the Darfur region of Sudan. Thousands there have once again been forced to flee their homes after attacks by the Sudanese government-supported rapid support forces, with reported air attacks by the Sudan Air Force. This has increased pressure on humanitarian groups working to help the displaced, a task made harder by government forces refusing to allow both aid groups and peacekeepers with the Joint African Union-United Nations Mission in Darfur, or UNMID, any access to the area to investigate the incidents. The Sudanese government made commitments to the United Nations and African Union to allow peacekeepers unhindered access to the region to protect civilians. These pledges must be kept. The United States is deeply concerned by the recent escalation of violence in Darfur. We condemn attacks on civilians and call on the government of Sudan to prevent further violence and cease its own campaign of aerial bombardments. Two recent incidents illustrate the scope of the violence. On February 23rd, members of the RSF attacked and robbed persons living in the Kalma refugee camp near Nyala, Sudan. 4 days later, on February 27th, the RSF burned homes and attacked civilians near Nyala itself. Media reports said that the Sudanese Air Force supported the operation, resulting in many casualties and forcing thousands to flee the area. The people of Darfur have suffered insecurity, violence, and atrocities for far too long. Together with the international community, we urge the Sudanese government and the armed movements to begin an inclusive, holistic, and comprehensive dialogue to achieve a peaceful solution to the conflicts in Sudan and reestablish the rule of law.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight,
comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.